Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to understanding what's driving the conversations on Hacker News. It's Tuesday, April 15th, 2025, and we've scanned the front page to bring you the most thought-provoking discussions. Whether you're deeply technical or just, you know, curious, think of us as your guides to the day's digital water cooler.
Exactly. And today's deep dive, it pulls together some pretty fascinating threads, I think. We'll be looking at everything from, well, a rather unusual security incident to the future of online censorship.
Okay.
Plus Europe's growing AI ambitions, the historical blueprint for, like, scientific dominance, and even some surprisingly applicable insights from, well, arguing with toddlers.
Huh. Okay, that last one sounds fun.
Yeah, all topics that really sparked significant debate and interest on today's Hacker News.
All right, let's jump right into the deep end then. That headline that practically screams internet, the 4chan shardy hack and the janitor email leak, sounds like pure chaos. What's the actual story here?
Well, yeah, peeling back the sensationalism, at its heart, the shardy hack was a clever technical maneuver.
Okay.
Someone managed to upload what looked like a PDF file, but under the hood, it was actually a specially crafted PostScript file. And this exploited a known weakness in an older version of GhostScript that software used to process these types of files.
Right, I've heard of GhostScript.
Yeah, so it basically allowed the attacker to run their own code on 4chan servers. Think of it like sneaking a master key disguised as a regular one past the doorman.
That's a vivid image. Now, there was a bit of a technical aside that popped up in the comments about whether PDF is just a type of PostScript file. Why did that even come up? Is it important?
It's actually a really insightful point, and it helps clarify the exploit.
Okay.
Because while PDFs did borrow some concepts from PostScript way back when, there are fundamentally distinct formats. Saying PDF is just PostScript is like saying a modern electric car is just a type of horse-drawn carriage because it both gets you places. The tech is different.
Okay, got it.
The key here is that PostScript is a full-fledged programming language, whereas PDF is not. So this malformed PostScript file could leverage GhostScript's ability to execute code.
Which a real PDF wouldn't do.
Exactly. That wouldn't be possible with a genuine PDF.
Yeah.
So the disguise, you know, the PDF disguise, was crucial to the attack.
Sneaky indeed. But as often happens with 4chan, the technical details were just the starting point for a much wider discussion about the platform itself. Right?
Absolutely.
The whole content and moderation debate.
Precisely. You saw the familiar battle lines drawn immediately.
Yeah.
On one side, the staunch defense of 4chan as this bastion of unfiltered free speech.
Yeah.
A digital space where even controversial or, frankly, offensive ideas can be aired without the heavy hand of moderation you see elsewhere. The argument being that this lack of censorship, while sometimes uncomfortable, is essential.
And then, of course, the counter argument, which is, well, hard to ignore given 4chan's history. The Hacker News discussion didn't shy away from the very real concerns about the platform hosting and sometimes amplifying harmful stuff.
No, it didn't.
Including racism, white supremacist ideologies, and its connection to real-world tragedies like the Buffalo and Christchurch shootings.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention being a breeding ground for movements like the Boogaloo. That's deeply troubling.
It is, and it forces us to confront a really difficult question.
Mm-hmm.
Does 4chan actively cultivate these harmful ideologies,
mm-hmm.
or is it more of a raw, unfiltered reflection of certain undercurrents in online culture?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Some argue that the anonymity and the lack of social reinforcement, like upvotes, actually work against forming echo chambers and that sort of moral grandstanding you see elsewhere.
How so?
The idea is, because nobody knows who you are and there's no score to keep, people might be less inclined to, like, performatively adhere to certain viewpoints just to fit in or score points.
That's a fascinating, if maybe unsettling, thought. Anonymity as both a shield for hate and a potential dampener on other toxic dynamics.
It's complex. And we also can't forget 4chan's undeniable cultural impact, you know, for better or worse.
True. It's been the birthplace of countless internet memes and slang.
Absolutely. Even if the origins are sometimes a bit murky or unsavory.
Yeah.
4chan has been a surprisingly influential incubator of internet culture. You see phrases and memes start there and eventually just seep into the mainstream, often totally stripped of their original context.
Right. People have no idea where they came from.
Exactly. It shows the power of these anonymous online spaces to generate and spread cultural trends.
Now, the other part of that headline was the janitor email leak.
Mm-hmm.
What was the buzz around that? Was it as big a deal as the hack itself?
Well, the discussion suggested this alleged leak involved internal site configurations, which, you know, could potentially expose sensitive information.
Okay, that sounds serious.
But it's crucial to note that the Hacker News conversation seemed to treat this part with a pretty healthy dose of skepticism. Many commenters pointed out that the reports seemed to trace back to less credible sources, like the Daily Mail, which were apparently just citing unverified social media rumors.
So maybe not much substance there.
It seems that way. While the GhostScript exploit seems confirmed, the extent and, frankly, the reality of this supposed email leak remained very much in question, based on the discussion.
So a tale of two parts, then. A confirmed technical vulnerability raising security questions alongside a more dubious claim of an internal leak, all unfolding within that complex, controversial 4chan ecosystem.
Yeah, it really underscores the ongoing challenges of security and content moderation in these big, anonymous online spaces.
Okay, let's pivot. Something that feels like it's on the cutting edge of digital cat and mouse games. The idea that it's easier than ever to de-censor videos. This sounds like a significant development.
It is indeed. The article focuses on emerging techniques to reverse the censorship of video content. Specifically, it highlights advancements in depixelation.
Depixelation. Okay. How does that work?
The core principle involves training AI models on just massive data sets of both censored and uncensored images and videos.
Right.
The AI basically learns the patterns of how information gets obscured by pixelation, and then uses that knowledge to try and reconstruct the original content.
That sounds incredibly sophisticated, but I imagine it's not perfect. What are the limitations?
You're right, it's definitely not foolproof. For one, the sheer computational power needed, especially for heavily pixelated areas or long videos, is a big constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the accuracy often relies on the AI making certain educated guesses or priors about what's underneath.
Like what it thinks should be there.
Exactly. Like if it's trying to depixelate text, it might look for patterns that resemble letters or words based on all the text it's seen during training.
The article also compared pixelation to blurring as censorship methods. Is one easier to reverse with AI?
That's a crucial distinction, yeah. While both obscure info, blurring tends to preserve more of the original data's underlying structure, just fuzzier. There are existing image processing techniques, like deconvolution, that can often reverse blurring to a noticeable degree.
Right.
Pixelation, especially with large pixel blocks, discards much more fine-grained detail. That generally makes it more resistant to current depixelation AI.
So bigger pixels are better for the sensor anyway.
Kind of. Think of it like trying to piece together a mosaic with really big tiles versus tiny fragments. The bigger tiles give you less information to work with.
It's like this constant arms race, isn't it? Sensors get better, desensors get better.
Pretty much.
The article even mentioned the seemingly old school Windows 98 approved method using solid black boxes and MS Paint. Is that still reliable against AI?
Surprisingly, yeah. It seems to hold up reasonably well against current AI depixelation.
Huh.
AI hasn't really figured out how to reliably reconstruct information hidden behind just a solid block of color because essentially that information has been completely replaced, not just obscured.
Okay.
However, as some in the Hacker News discussion pointed out, even that isn't an absolute guarantee. There have been cases where seemingly solid redactions, even black ones, have been partially reversed because of like metadata or residual info embedded within the file format itself. Digital secrets can be surprisingly leaky.
Wow.
And they also mentioned drizzling, a technique from astronomy for enhancing faint images, as another potential approach for depixelation by combining multiple pixelated frames.
So the overarching message here seems to be that in the digital world, true irreversible censorship is getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
Basically. If something makes it online, its confidentiality just can't be taken for granted.
Exactly. The writing seems to be on the wall. As AI keeps evolving, traditional digital censorship methods are likely to become less and less effective.
So the best censorship is just not posting it.
That might just be the most reliable form of the digital age, yeah. Don't put it out there in the first place.
A sobering thought. Okay, let's switch gears again. This time to the fascinating world of large language models. There was buzz around toucan7b base and toucan7b instruct and their significance as towards European LLMs. What's the big picture?
Yeah, this is a really interesting development. It's focused on building these large language models, or LLMs, specifically within Europe.
Toucan.
Toucan. The 7B likely refers to 7 billion parameters. That's a measure of the model's size and complexity.
Right.
And the base and instruct parts tell you about the development stage. A base model is initially trained on just a massive amount of raw text data. It learns the fundamental patterns of language.
Okay, the foundation.
Exactly. Then the instruct model takes that base model and gets further training, fine-tuning, using specific instructions and examples of conversations.
Ah, so it learns to follow directions in chat.
Precisely. That fine-tuning makes it much better at understanding and responding to natural language prompts in a helpful conversational way, like, you know, ChatGPT or similar assistants.
And why the big emphasis on European LLMs? What's the driving force here?
Well, there are several pretty compelling reasons. Data sovereignty is likely a big one.
Meaning keeping the data and tech under European rules.
Yeah, exactly. Having LLMs developed and hosted in Europe means the data used for training and the tech itself fall under European legal frameworks and regulations, like GDPR.
Makes sense. What else?
Linguistic diversity is another important factor. Models trained mainly on, say, American English data sets might not capture the nuances of various European languages as well.
Good point.
So developing models within Europe allows for better optimization and representation of all these languages. And finally, there's a strategic angle.
Competition, independence.
Both. Fostering local innovation in AI, which is obviously critical, and reducing reliance on models developed elsewhere. That has big implications for economic competitiveness and technological independence. The fact that this is getting traction on Hacker News really highlights the tech community's strong interest in seeing Europe become a more significant player in the whole LLM landscape.
It definitely underscores that global race in AI development. Now let's step back in time a bit. The article, How the U.S. Became a Science Superpower, it delves into the history, the factors that propelled America to the forefront. What were the key ingredients?
Yeah, the article draws this really insightful comparison between the U.S. and British approaches during World War II.
Okay.
In Britain, under Churchill and his scientific advisor, Lindemann, they had a very centralized model. Research was focused primarily in government labs.
Which had some successes, right? Like radar.
Oh, definitely. It led to significant breakthroughs, radar, code breaking, absolutely.
Right.
But, the argument goes, it lacked the adaptability and, crucially, the scalability needed for long-term post-war scientific dominance.
And the U.S. took a fundamentally different path.
Totally different. The U.S., largely driven by Vannevar Bush's vision, he really saw the pivotal role of science and tech in winning the war, adopted a much more decentralized and collaborative approach.
How so?
A key element was massive investment in university-based research, channeled to the Office of Scientific Research and Development, the OSRD.
So universities were put right at the heart of it.
Exactly. Places like MIT, Caltech, Harvard, Columbia, many others became these major hubs for developing cutting-edge tech for the war effort. And what's really striking is the scale of commitment. Nearly 10,000 scientists and engineers, faculty, grad students got draft deferments specifically to work in these university labs.
Wow, 10,000.
Yeah, it effectively transformed these universities into key partners in wartime research.
That's a huge level of support. And the funding must have been enormous, too.
Oh, massive. Between 41 and 45, the OSRD funneled something like the equivalent of $9 billion in today's dollars into these top research universities. And this cash influx didn't just support specific projects, it fundamentally strengthened the entire research infrastructure within those institutions.
So it wasn't just project funding, it was about building a long-term foundation, capacity building.
Exactly right. And a crucial, often overlooked aspect of this was the indirect cost reimbursement system.
What's that?
Well, the government didn't just pay for the researchers' salaries and direct project costs, like lab equipment. It also gave money to the universities to cover the overhead.
Like buildings, administration, lights.
Precisely. Maintaining facilities, admin support, utilities, libraries, all that stuff. This, the article argues, was kind of the secret sauce.
How so?
It allowed U.S. universities to develop and sustain world-class research labs, which in turn attracted top talent from all over the globe. The famous brain drain.
Ah, I see. It built the environment for the science.
You got it. It sounds like a really smart strategic investment.
What were the lasting effects after the war? How did the U.S. and U.K. models differ then?
Well, the legacies were quite different. Britain's more centralized model, while effective short-term, didn't really foster the same deep integration between university research and private industry that you needed for large-scale post-war innovation and mass production. The U.S., on the other hand, had built this robust, decentralized ecosystem. it seamlessly connected fundamental research in universities with the commercialization power of private companies. That really set the stage for its long-term scientific and technological leadership.
Fascinating how those wartime decisions still shape things today. The article also touches on current discussions about maintaining that U.S. scientific lead, right? What are the concerns now?
Yeah, there's a growing awareness, maybe even anxiety, about the rapid advancements elsewhere, most notably China.
Right.
One commenter, someone with decades in radar research, mentioned seeing a huge jump in both the quantity and quality of Chinese scientific papers in their field.
Suggesting the gap is closing.
Or maybe even reversing in some areas, according to them. This obviously leads to concerns about potential cuts to U.S. research funding and the need for, you know, strategic investments to stay competitive.
And within the U.S. system itself, are there debates about how money is spent? Efficiency?
Absolutely. There are ongoing discussions about whether university administrative costs, those overheads we talked about, are too high now.
Okay.
And also the balance between basic versus applied research. The example of theoretical physics like string theory came up.
Yeah.
Some argued that despite decades of funding and brilliant minds working on it, it hasn't yielded tangible real-world applications yet, which leads to questions about resource allocation, how much for blue-sky thinking versus more immediate problems. It's a constant balancing act.
It seems the U.S. ascent wasn't just about money, but a specific strategic approach. Collaboration, yeah. Infrastructure, long-term vision. Okay, final topic. Something that sounds a bit lighter, but maybe has universal lessons. How to win an argument with a toddler.
Yeah.
Obviously, the article isn't just about actual toddlers, is it?
No, exactly. The cleverness is using that dynamic, arguing with a toddler, as a metaphor for dealing with all sorts of difficult or seemingly irrational people.
Like who?
Could be a stubborn colleague, someone really dug into their beliefs, maybe even a hostile commenter online. Anyone who seems resistant to just pure logic.
Okay. And the core idea is?
The central argument is that winning these kinds of arguments often isn't about logically dismantling their case. It's more about validating their emotions and understanding their underlying needs or concerns first.
Validate their emotions. How does that work when someone seems completely unreasonable?
Well, the article gives practical examples, like acknowledging their feelings before you set boundaries.
So instead of just saying, you're wrong.
Right. You might say something like, I understand why you feel that way, or it sounds like you're really frustrated about this.
Okay.
This makes the other person feel heard and understood, which can actually lower their defenses and make them more receptive to what you have to say later.
So it's about making that emotional connection first.
Precisely. It's recognizing that so many arguments, even between adults, are driven by underlying emotions. The piece makes the point that almost every problem starts with someone feeling hurt, ignored, or misunderstood somehow. Mm-hmm. By validating those feelings, you address the root cause, not just the surface argument.
But validation isn't the same as agreeing, right, or giving in.
Absolutely not. That's a key distinction. Validation is about making them feel heard, acknowledging their perspective is real to them. It doesn't mean you agree or abandon your own goals.
So you could say, I get that you really want to stay up late.
But it's still bedtime. Exactly. I understand you want X, but we need to do Y.
That makes a lot of sense. Logic often just bounces off when emotions are high. The article also mentioned the goal of an argument isn't always about persuasion.
That's another key point. It suggests that often, especially in online or public arguments, the goal isn't really to change the other person's mind.
What is it then?
It might be more about performing for the audience, the onlookers. Or maybe just clarifying your own position calmly and clearly. In those cases, just articulating your views without getting sucked into an emotional fight can be a form of winning.
Interesting. There is also mention of tactical believing. What's that about?
Tactical believing is this idea of temporarily adopting a posture of understanding, maybe even agreement, even if you don't fully share their view.
Why do that?
The goal is to build rapport. Make them feel like you're genuinely trying to see it from their side. This can make them way more open to hearing your perspective later. It's got a subtle form of empathy in communication.
Okay.
The piece also suggests approaching disagreements with real curiosity, asking questions like, help me understand why you think that, or I'm confused, can we talk this through, instead of just jumping straight to a rebuttal.
That sounds like a much more productive way to handle things, whether it's a toddler having a meltdown or someone dug into a really strong belief. But the discussion also touched on a potential pitfall, right? Being too open.
Yes, exactly. The context of the rationalist community came up, raising this concern that an excessive openness to changing one's mind, maybe without enough critical evaluation, could potentially make someone more susceptible to manipulation.
Or even cult indoctrination, it mentioned.
Yeah, this is the extreme example discussed. It's just a reminder that critical thinking and a healthy dose of skepticism are still essential, even when you're practicing empathy and validation. You need balance.
So the key takeaway from our dip into toddler arguments seems to be that effective communication, even when facing irrationality, often starts with empathy, understanding, and genuinely trying to acknowledge the other person's feelings.
Right.
Whether they're literally a toddler, a tough debater, or anyone in between.
Precisely. Recognizing those emotional undercurrents and disagreements and addressing those first can often be the most effective path to navigating conflict and hopefully having more productive conversations.
Well, there you have it. Another deep dive into the front page of Hacker News. Today, we went from the nitty-gritty of a 4chan hack all the way to the surprising wisdom from arguing with toddlers, plus a lot in between.
Yeah.
It's always fascinating to see the sheer range of topics that grab the attention of this community.
It truly is. And when you look at these seemingly unconnected discussions together, you start to see some interesting threads, don't you?
Like what?
Well, like the challenges of moderating a place like 4chan definitely speak to the broader difficulties of controlling information flow online, which ties right into that discussion about decensoring tech.
Yeah, good point.
And similarly, the history lesson on how the U.S. became a science superpower offers, you know, valuable context as other regions, like Europe with its AI push, aim to become global leaders in critical tech fields.
Absolutely. It's all part of this really complex, always evolving landscape of technology, culture, and how we all interact. So we encourage you, our listener, to keep these insights in mind as you navigate your own online world, and maybe even revisit some of these topics on Hacker News yourself. There's always more to dig into.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We hope it's given you a valuable snapshot of the conversations shaping our digital world today.